The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Tuesday, May 2nd, 2023. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jane McAlevey, Senior Policy Fellow at the University of California, Berkeley's Labor Center, co-author of Rules to Win, Power and Participation in Union Negotiations with Abby Lawler. Also on the program today, Biden and McCarthy to meet over debt ceiling. Meanwhile, Janet Yellen saying the crisis, the debt crisis, will start June 1st of this year. In Hollywood, New York, across the country, TV and film writers, the WGA strikes starting this morning, halting late night TV shows. And see what happens in terms of all production, even scripts that may already be written. But no scripts are being written henceforth for your favorite and even least favorite television programs. Pilots at American and Southwest are getting ready for their own strike. Representative Zoe Zephyr sues to access the Montana House floor. Oklahoma governor signs a ban on health care for trans kids. Florida Governor DeSantis defies the Supreme Court by signing a law that expands the death penalty down there. Democratic Senator Ben Cardin announces his retirement. Vice Media headed to bankruptcy. And new report, Russian warplane almost accidentally shot down a manned British surveillance aircraft back in September. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Do we need to take a break? Is my image okay? Showing up on my thing is all scrambled up. No,
oh, looking good for us.
Weird.
Yeah, you're fine.
Well, folks.
Probably the 400 tabs you have open on your computer.
That one computer, I don't have any tabs open on that one at all.
It can feel the tabs in the other computer.
Too many tabs being opened in other computers.
It's empathizing with the rest of your computers.
Oddly, like the image of you coming up and Bradley and Matt is no problem, but the one that's going out is completely still to me. So,
well, you're crystal clear for us.
Fantastic. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Of course, it is. Well, Emma, sometimes we break format. Newsday Tuesday, not so much today. No. I mean, a little bit. But Emma Viglin is here. I can't tell if she's up on screen because my screen is frozen.
I'm here.
And she is here.
I'm somehow here.
Folks, we should just say right off the bat that it was a rough night for Emma in particular because the Rangers lost. And
yeah, they were going all in this year, so it's pretty bad. The only thing that saves me, honestly, in walking in today is that my buddy Bradley's happy, which truly, that's like literally it. But let's stop talking about it
because
I'm going to sue.
Honestly,
you
I think Emma
stress.
Was going to cry today. I really
I cried
thought
last
this
night.
Morning that
I'll
you
be honest with you. I cried last night like three or four times.
Celtics had a rough night, but that was game one.
Yeah. Well, that too. Yeah. I mean, whatever. I need like a brain transplant or something else that like reverses my desire to care this much about teams where I have no control over it. I wish I could go back in my life and change my brain chemistry.
The eternal sunshine of the Rangers-less mind.
Yes.
Meanwhile, in the Senate, I mean, if you're okay to move on.
Yeah, I am fine. I mean, again, I will reiterate, if you continue talking about this, I'm suing you for emotional distress.
All right. I have a feeling there's a lot of people getting sued today. Senate Judiciary Committee is having a hearing today on the potential for some form of ethics reform of the Supreme Court. And what is being at least floated in some quarters is, you know, holding them to the same ethical standards as the rest of the federal judiciary. The entire 9-member Supreme Court signed a letter, I believe it was a day or two ago, basically saying we don't need that. We have our own interior processes, and you have to trust that. And
trust us to investigate ourselves. That works out well every time.
And I want to, on one level, I want to say, oh, well, you know, the three liberals on the court, as it were, they sort of feel like they've got to sign this to show some solidarity, because it's not like them not signing on to it would mean anything different. And you want them to be able to maintain their relationship with the other members of the court. And, you know, forget that. I'm sorry. I just don't buy it. It is quite clear that there needs to be ethical reforms. Here is Senator Sheldon Whitehouse talking about this insane legislation that he introduced, which would require Supreme Court justices to, and this is a radical concept, adopt a code of ethics.
Only Supreme Court justices refuse to allow their conduct to be investigated or reviewed. My bill would fix that. Here's an example of the no investigations problem. The key fact to determine whether Justice Thomas was bound by law to recuse himself from the first January 6th committee case was what he knew about his wife's insurrection activities and when he knew it. On that fact, the lawfulness of his initial recusal decision turns. Yet Thomas has never been officially asked that question. It's a cover-up in plain view. The Supreme Court alone among federal courts is okay with that. My bill would fix that.
And yet, it's a problem. Remember, over 12 years ago now, there were two Supreme Court justices, Scalia and Breyer, I believe it was, who were testifying to the Senate Judiciary Committee because of ethical questions regarding Clarence Thomas and Harlan Crowe, if you can imagine, 11, 12 years ago. That's been memory hold.
What was that, after the LA Times piece, and then he just stopped disclosing the Harlan Crowe gifts? That was what it is, right, Bradley?
You lay low.
He had, because the LA
Times,
he started disclosing
it,
in 2004, the LA Times wrote about it. Then he just kept up the relationship, even ramped it up, and just stopped disclosing it.
And we got an ethics problem. Here is, Senator John Kennedy poo-pooing the whole idea of this. Republican from Louisiana. Here he is.
Justices are operating with. The danger isn't that rogue justices are operating without ethics. It's that Democrats aren't winning every fight and they find that reality intolerable. I've been disappointed by Supreme Court opinions, too. But my Democratic colleagues should fill out a hurt feelings report and move on for the sake of the Constitution.
Yeah, well, incidentally, there's no such thing as a hurt feelings report. And but it is a good example of why these ethical issues need to be dealt with in the moment, because otherwise you got yahoos like Kennedy. And by yahoo, I just mean fake yahoo. He
Harvard educated.
I think he studied at Oxford Rhodes Scholar.
I mean, he did study at Foghorn Leghorn Studies, but
that's where he went and learned the accent, essentially. But the bottom line is you got to deal with these ethical violations as they come. There needs to be a dramatic reform of the Supreme Court. It's quite clear. Just while we're on the topic of hurt feelings, let's just compare and contrast for a moment. When Democrats supposedly have hurt feelings regarding the court, they introduce legislation saying that we need a code of conduct of ethics like we have for the rest of the federal judiciary. When Republicans don't like the federal judiciary's behavior, You get a senator goes on the floor like John Cornyn did. Do we have the video of this? Oh, and here it is, where John Cornyn back in 2005 writes, it causes a lot of people, including me, great distress to see judges use the authority that they have been given to make raw political or ideological decisions, he said. Sometimes, he said, the Supreme Court has taken on this role of policymaker rather than enforcer of political decisions made by elective representatives of the people. I don't know if there's a cause and effect connection, but we've seen some episodes, recent episodes of courthouse violence in this country. And I wonder if whether there may be some connection between the perception in some quarters on some occasions where judges are making political decisions yet are unaccountable to the public, that it builds up and builds up and builds up to the point where some people engage in violence. Certainly without any justification, but I have a concern that I have.
Mm.
Well, certainly without justification, which is the preceding paragraph.
In other words, let me just, exactly, I've just provided, you know, half a dozen sentences of justifying violence, but there is no justification. That turn of phrase is essentially the equivalent of me going on a right winger showing and a show and saying, with all due respect, mm-hmm. I think everybody knows what I'm doing.
Right. Well, it's fascinating too, because there hasn't been really anything that's come out thus far about Ketanji Brown Jackson, Elena Kagan, any of the more liberal justices on the Supreme Court. I'm not saying that they don't have ethical violations too. I'm sure they get paid bizarre sums of money to speak, and it's more just about enriching them to get influence. Sure. But there is no equivalent mechanism on the left that the right has with the Federalist Society and with the deep, deep pockets that go into, like, universities just there, the Scalia School, just to pay money to Gorsuch and to Thomas. And that's why Republican senators get so defensive of it, because they're all working in tandem together. It's one big political operation, and they know that that is what fuels the right-wing extremism on the Supreme Court.
And we should say, you know, for example, Ketanji Brown Jackson has recused herself. We don't know why, on this maritime fishery case, which could end up destroying the Chevron doctrine. One of the most important cases that the Supreme Court will hear in terms of administrative law, certainly in this, you know, 6-3 configuration, without a doubt. But one, in terms of administrative law, one of the most important ones they could hear. And, you know, administrative law makes it sound very unsexy, but it is very sexy in regard to how much it can be disastrous for the ability of our government to protect citizens. And she recuses herself. We don't know why. That is the way that they do this. But when you look at, like, what Thompson refuses to recuse himself from, it's stunning.
Stuff directly involving his wife.
Yeah. I mean,
that's why we need ethics standards for the Supreme Court. They're not literal descendants from God. I know that they believe that they are. They have lifetime appointments to just hand down decrees. But they actually are human beings that need ethics standards, too.
Well, uber human beings.
Right.
Superhumans.
I forgot about that.
Folks, in a moment, we're going to be talking to Jane McAlevey, a senior policy fellow at the University of California. She's got a new book that she co-authored, Rules to Win By: Power and Participation in Union Negotiations, with Abby Lawler. But before we get there, word from our sponsor. And it is the sponsor. It's great when we have these ads, because it reminds me to take my Liquid IV out of the fridge, because I like it chilled. I come in the morning, fill it up, and then I put it in the fridge to chill it so that it's ready for the show.
Very nice.
And I just tip my hand. But today's sponsor, Liquid IV. Festival season, people are going out to, like, rock, you know, like 3-day rock or music shows.
Yeah, 3-day rock shows. Yeah,
I don't know what people call it anymore. That's music, okay. Shows, festivals.
No, festivals.
Right. These all developed. There was no festivals when I was a kid. Anyway, Liquid IV, perfect to bring to those festivals, because you're going to get dehydrated. Super mm-hmm. hot. Liquid IV hydrates 2 times faster than water alone. with three times the electrolytes of traditional sports drinks. One stick of Liquid IV in 16 ounces of water hydrates you, like I say, two times faster and more efficiently than just water. There are 12 delicious, refreshing flavors. I happen to be going with the tangerine immunity one because that's just, I've been on a jag for like for months on that. For a long time, it was the matcha. I couldn't get off the matcha, the energy one.
Right.
And then also I had the pina colada fixation and my watermelon fixation. Probably when we get into the summer, I'm going to go back to...
I stole some of those pina coladas. That's the thing.
When I go back to in the summer, I think pina colada and watermelon are going to be big. But also they got the green apple. I don't know. They got a bunch of different flavors. They're delicious. Liquid IV contains essential vitamins B3, B5, B6, B12. Vitamin C has three times the electrolytes of traditional sports drinks. I think it's all the Bs that make, you know, help with uptake of vitamins. That's what I've been reading lately, but I don't know. It's made with premium ingredients. It's non-GMO. It's free from gluten. It's free from dairy. It's free from soy, of course. And Liquid IV, on top of all that, they partner with organizations to help communities protect both their water and their futures. They donated 39 million servings in 50-plus countries around the world so far.
Wow.
Again, super convenient. You can put a couple of little packages in your bag if you're traveling. I brought it on our trip to London. I took with the kids, and that way stayed hydrated on the plane. They stay hydrated on the plane afterwards. It's great if you know that, like, I don't know, you're going to a wedding. Emma's going to a bunch of weddings this summer.
Yeah.
And this is what you bring.
Well, I'm going on a flight next week. I'm off for a little bit, and I already have it in my little packing list.
You can take your acai,
yeah,
your favorite.
And the pina colada I've snagged from you.
They have a Seabury, too, apparently, that it's pretty good.
Ah.
Anyways, grab your Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco, or you can get 20% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MAJORITYREP. It's MAJORITYREP at checkout. That's 20% off of anything you order at when you shop Better Hydration today using the promo code MAJORITYREP at liquidiv.com. We will put the code and the link in the podcast and YouTube descriptions and as well at majority.fm. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, Jane McAlevey. We are back, Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland. It is a real pleasure to welcome back to the program Jane McAlevey. She is Senior Policy Fellow at the University of California, Berkeley's Labor Center, co-author of Rules to Win By, Power and Participation in Union Negotiations. She co-wrote it with Abby Lawler. Jane, welcome back to the program. You know, as I realize this, like, I think it's possible that you're one of our most frequent guests that we've had over the past 3 or 4 years. We generally don't have folks on too much, in a row. A lot of books to get to, a lot of different people. But this has been, I think, at least in my lifetime, I think, well, I shouldn't say that. but because that's been a little bit longer than maybe I want to. But certainly within the past, like I feel like 3 decades, the most active union labor period that we have experienced. And so many people have told us that, you know, talking to you has been so helpful in when they try and unionize their workplaces. And you have basically written a sequel to your organizing book, No Shortcuts. Just remind us what No Shortcuts was about, and then we can sort of set up what this sort of next step is.
Yeah, great. First of all, I'm flattered, honestly, that I'm here so often because I think it's a show. So No Shortcuts, I mean, the sort of, you know, there's 4 books in 10 years, right? And they were all in it. I mean, the first one was an accident, and then the rest of them almost were, except for this one. So this one's a sequel to No Shortcuts. And No Shortcuts was my late in life PhD dissertation. But the evidence for it and all the knowledge for it, of course, came from workers in the field. I mean, that's where I've learned everything, is fight by fight in the field. So No Shortcuts basically said, hey, there's a lot of talk out there about organizing. And the truth is, in my observation, most people who talk about organizing aren't actually doing organizing, which I define. The whole book is about defining what's mobilizing, which is when you're focused on the people who already agree with you, but you're trying to get them off the couch to take action, versus organizing, which is when we're actually focused every single day on people who are mostly undecided about whether or not they self-identify with any movement, and often, as I argue, initially think they're opposed to whatever their cause is, in this case, a trade union. And that's in part because of the extraordinary multi-billionaire effort to demonize what a trade union has been for so long. So the real, what I was trying to met out was that in the era I came in as a trade union organizer full-time, as a senior organizer at the National American Federation of Labor, Congress of Industrial Organizations in 1996, we're all getting old here, in 1996 when I began, you know, there's a lot of talk that we were trying to do organizing, that we're going to reorganize the labor movement. And in short, my analysis of my time with both the National AFL-CIO and then as National Deputy Director at the SEIU with both of them in that first decade was, in fact, we weren't organizing. We were doing something called mobilizing. We were relying on a small number of workers who already agreed with us. And then the narrative became that organizing didn't work. And that's what made me sit down kind of angry to write a book that said, let's get clear about what we need more of, which is organizing. And when we actually do it correctly, those of us who do it, we just keep winning. And if we take these shortcuts, which is mobilizing and getting a telegenic worker in front of a TV camera, that ain't organizing. And you simply can't get to the kind of supermajorities that we saw on the LA picket lines recently in Los Angeles, right, with the educators. I think we're about to see on the WGA lines today, the Writers Guild, on the Oakland education strike lines that begin Thursday or tomorrow, actually, right? And you're right, there's a lot happening. So No Shortcuts really says, wait a minute. It's a challenge to the national trade union movement. And it says, hell yes, organizing works. You've abandoned it. You've abandoned workers as the central agents in our own salvation. And you've taken these shortcuts about shareholder damage and crashing stock prices and clever things that actually don't work. And you're calling them organizing. So what I was trying to really parse out for people is organizing does still work. It's about base expansion. Are we bringing people into the movement who previously weren't involved? Then you get to mobilize them. You know, then you get to put them out on a picket line or help them understand, you know, who they might want to vote for in an election. But the first step is rebuilding a base of people in this country in supermajority levels that leads to the kind of victory that we saw in Los Angeles with a 30% raise off of a 3-day strike recently, right? A 30% raise. That's the kind of gains that workers need in this country after taking it in the neck from, you know, everything that's been going wrong for 50 years.
Someone had asked me, it was a while back, someone had asked me about your book, and I had summed it up in borrowing a phrase I had heard quite a bit in terms of when you're supposed to hire a lawyer. But it was basically the best time to organize is when you don't need to have the organization yet. Like you can't mobilize unless you have already done the work prior to that and begun to organize. And I don't know if it's all been since the last time that you've been on, but we've talked about to a couple of the people who were in in Buffalo organizing the Starbucks people. We've talked to people in Trader Joe's. We have talked to musicians and teachers, and you know, the one thing that I think really at least in part to your work, is that people started to understand they need to start to build relationships way before they can mobilize anything. And so, and then one of the things that I have subsequently learned too is we just had on organizers from Starbucks when Schultz was talking, was this gap between the unionization and the actual first contract, and that is in many ways almost as perilous a time, if not more so, than the run-up to the unionization effort in the first place, because the desire to break the union does not end prior to the election. It goes through all, particularly until that first contract. Tell us about that dynamic, because I think in your book you cite something like 52% of new unions do not have a contract within the first year. Just tell us about that dynamic.
Yeah, and we're seeing it actually in the Starbucks campaign in a couple of headlines in the last week. So, yes, this is why organizers say the organizing never stops, right? It can't stop. So under United States labor law, which I think I've probably said before, I prefer to call boss law or employer law, because the idea that it works for workers is a bit of a myth. But under the National Labor Relations Act and under sort of currently settled law, most people in this country think that when workers vote to form a union, they just go right into contract negotiations, and somehow there's some obligation on the part of the employer to sit down and be fair and start negotiating, right? Hey, a majority of workers voted for the union. No, no. And not only does that not happen, but under labor law, at the 12-month mark, if your union has been certified, and in the case of some of the Starbucks elections, the early ones, they got certified. If your union, unlike Amazon, contrast that, right? There's no certification still of that election. Amazon's taking a different approach. They're going to fight even saying that there is a union. So what I'm about to say doesn't even really apply to them. At Starbucks, the unions got certified by the National Labor Relations Board. This was a valid election, yada, yada. Okay. What happens under labor law is that if there is not a union contract negotiated within 12 months, the employer, though officially the law says workers, may then file for what's called a decertification of the union. In essence, the original intent was, you know, if it's not getting you anything, feel free to throw the union out. But what that has become for all of our lifetimes has become the second chance to destroy the worker organization. Not only has it become that, it's like they, you know, they're totally motivated by that, right? They understand all they have to do is drag this crap out for 12 more months and they can go inspire would be the polite word. Because officially the employer can't do this. In every campaign where I've ever faced such a hurdle, which you might imagine I have, having gone up against some of the biggest private sector employers in the healthcare industry, who will spend as much money as Amazon, you know, to bust the union. We know exactly how it happens, right? You have to get 30% of workers to say, I'm dissatisfied with the union. The employer runs a message saying, hey, it's been 12 months and you don't have a contract yet. Why don't you throw the bums out and we'll cut a better deal with you? Well, only reason there isn't a contract in that 12 months is because the employer kept the union busters there and just kept running divide and conquer. They go form a little committee. This goes back to something I covered in my previous book, They go back to, this goes back to 1939 in the Sears and Roebuck Corporation. This is actually where they figured it out. They collect the bosses at Sears and Roebuck, a titan in the 1930s, went to the University of Chicago, where they were headquarters, right? The Sears Tower, Sears World headquarters was in Chicago. They went to the University of Chicago Behavioral Psychology Department, which was very preeminent at the time. I remember Alinsky, it was a whole bunch of interesting people there, but for different reasons. Famously, behavioral sociology and behavioral psych department. And they actually hired them. And what they, this is the beginning of official union busting. And what they came to was, as long as they got workers, a workers committee, if they could find a few workers to call up the workers committee to throw the union out, they stood a better chance of winning. So they officially never look like it's them. And under labor law, they can't officially, the boss, be the one who does it. But in my lifetime, they will pull a bunch of workers into a broom closet in a hospital. And after dragging things out for 12 months after the workers won, they will say, hey, this is pretty awful. You know, why don't we just get rid of it and go back to the way things were? And, you know, it's only if you've done the organizing work. It's only if you've identified the correct leaders, the real worker leaders. It's only if you've done a good job up front as union organizers of telling this to workers from day one, day one. And that's where some people take shortcuts and don't do it, right? In my life experience, I say from day one, by the way, as soon as you win the election, get ready for the hard part of the fight, because that's what's going to come next. It's actually winning your contract. So everything that we do to build our power in the lead up to a National Labor Relations Board election has to, like, set us up to then go for the next round of the fight. And we better be in a great position to force the employer's hand. So yeah, that's how it works. It's an extraordinarily, it's why I call it boss law or employer law. It's you call it labor law. It's a stretch.
What do you say when you see major corporations like Amazon and Starbucks union busting just because they can, because they are these major corporations that can just eat the fees? It's nothing to them. It's the cost of doing business. In fact, it's actually, in the long term, much more beneficial for them to send a message for their corporate profits than it is to abide by the letter of the law. Like, how do you communicate that to organizers, that this might happen and we're in this for the long fight?
Yeah. I mean, look, it is part of why, you know, every couple of years after running some campaigns, I just decide, and watching who's doing good work, I just decide to write another book. Because one, I want to keep showing that despite all these barriers, actually workers win, right? When we do our work right, we still can win. That's been the point of every single one of the books. So it starts with being transparent, clear, and open from the minute you're talking to workers. This is going to be a hard fight. You frame the choice. You can either choose to live with undignified pay, no respect, bad scheduling, no staff, not enough people, and feel like you left, you know, every day when you leave the workplace, you were in a combat zone and you're so exhausted and freaked out, like nurses and healthcare workers are, that they feel like they go into PTSD every day when they leave their shift, right? So you've got to frame a choice. You can either choose to do nothing, don't form a union, and keep living with the horrible conditions you're living in, or you can choose to do something about it and form a union. But I want to be honest from day one, it's going to take a hell of a lot of work. And the more honest you are, the more you treat workers with the, like, they have big brains. They actually are smart people, right? They run the economy really indirectly. So it's like, the more you acknowledge up front what it's really going to take to win, that's what staves off the ability for the employer to run a decertification at the 12-month mark, right? It's when it's a surprise. It's when, you know, not effective unions will not tell all these things that are going to happen. It's like, we do what's called inoculation and transparency. You've just got to be clear from day one that there is going to be a hell of a fight to come. And the first thing we have to do is get strong enough inside this workplace to win the vote. And the minute we win the vote, in the method I write about and talk about in No Shortcuts, and certainly in the new book, and in all of them, and what I practice is, the minute we've won that vote, we're going to start to build the support team around those workers. So we're going to chart, we're going to have the workers begin to chart their connections to the broader community. We're going to have them start to go talk to their ministers, their faith leaders, their soccer, you know, if it was Vegas, it was like soccer clubs, football, you know, depending on where you are in the world. Whatever it's going to take to actually have enough support around the workers to realize they made a good decision really matters. When the fight is like feels like a slog, and you've got to bring the community into that fight. And in the case of some of the newer retail folks, I think the missing element still, honestly, is we've got to refound a consumers union as strong as the one we had in the early 1900s, when the cigar workers and a bunch of unions built a real consumers union. That when they said, you know, look for the label, right? The old song of like, look for the, don't ask me to sing, I'm horrible, I can chant. But, you know, look for the union label, which is this, came out of a consumers union in 1905. And that's a missing element, I think, in some of the recent work we're doing. Like, hello, I keep saying someone needs to go form that organization and do it really well. And it can't be people who take shortcuts. It can't be advocacy types and stuff. It actually has to be organizers, right? Who actually know how to build an organization of consumers who are going to become a key weapon in some of these higher turnover workplaces. But for the vast majority of people, whether it's Teamsters, UAW, Oakland teachers who are about to go on strike, the WGA, I mean, most workers have access to a lot of power in their own community, and the labor movement just leaves that power sitting on the table. And that's what I'm talking about in the new book, right? I mean, I wanted to call the book Leave No Power on the Table, to be perfectly honest, because we're in a climate where you have to do a power structure analysis and maximize every single piece of how the boss is going to go after you and how much power you can build. And what I've been saying to workers, I've been involved in a big campaign I can't, of course, talk about. It's always the most interesting work, can't talk about it yet. But like, what I'm always saying to people is, if you don't do a power structure analysis effectively, and if you leave the community out, it isn't just that you're leaving power on the table. It's that the employer class is going to step into that space and rip the power from you. So really the new book is about like leaving no power on the table in an era of vicious union busting. We won in the 30s by not letting power on the table and doing a good power analysis and being honest and transparent and clear and leading with worker leaders. And those of us doing it are still winning today using the same methods, basically.
There's a lot in there. I was determined to have my next question go directly to some of these case studies, but I still have a couple of general ones now that you've raised. I mean, just working backwards from that, like the idea of, and I've heard what you're describing when you ask your members to go into the community, find the sources of like shared grievance, shared experience, values that social justice unionism as opposed to managerial one. And I think I first heard that from Barbara Maglione, who was a longtime head of the Massachusetts school. And that union has very successfully organized against like the charter expansion and many other things. Idea of like, it's almost equivalent to, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. If the union doesn't access the power that resides in the community, the employer will grab that power. How does that happen? Like, is it, you know, if you're not going to those folks and making your case, the employer is going to come in and have them work against the unionization effort?
Yeah, absolutely. The best example, meaning a horrific example, the best example was the attempt by the previous leadership of the United Auto Workers. Thank goodness there's been a big change there. But in the old guard leadership of the corrupt UAW, in the big election that was probably 7 or 8 years ago in Tennessee, where the United Auto Workers had actually gotten an agreement for what was called a fair election procedure, an election procedure agreement.
Was it the Nissan plant in Tennessee? BMW. Okay.
Nissan was Alabama. So it went before that. And yeah, it was BMW and Volkswagen specifically.
Volkswagen. Right.
So I'm like reaching back because the example was so real. So this is what I mean about shortcuts. Okay. The old UAW leadership, not very creative, pretty corrupt, went and thought, you know, we're going to have an easy time because now we've got the European Union, IG Metall, to get the employer to say they won't fight the union. Well, there's a little misunderstanding of the power analysis there, just for starters. So that meant that they sent like the B, or I said in an article, UAW sent like a C team in terms of people who knew what they were doing. So that's a problem. But they did that based on the false assumption that the employer wouldn't fight back. Well, what the employer did, to make a long story very short, is they kind of followed the letter of the law. Like, they didn't form the committee and fight back inside the workplace. They literally organized the wives, fair gendered, right? It's famous. They went and organized the wives in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and the churches and the right-wing politicians. By the way, we're talking about Tennessee, so everyone has a little familiarity with how conservative that place is from recent happenings there. They went and literally, when I was interviewing people, went to the wives, and the wives, thinking about losing their jobs, went to their parishes. The parishes went to the politicians, and all of them ran a gigantic campaign to vote no against the union, and it worked. So that's the most like obvious example of literally a corporation figuring out we can get around this election procedure agreement, fair election agreement, by going to organize in the community to go against, to persuade the worker. So the wives organized their husbands to vote no in the end. It was amazing.
And I think if I remember correctly, it got national attention because you had federal senators get involved in that. I don't know if who it was, like Corker maybe? Yeah. And I don't remember who the other senator was. But I remember that garnered a lot of attention to hear a senator talk about a unionization. Against the unionization drive in, you know, their state. That's unique. All right. Well, that's a perfect example of that. Like, any source of potential power for you is also a source of potential power for management in that instance. The other thing, consumer union. I don't know if people are familiar with that concept today, really. I remember the look for the union label ads. But I don't know if there's been any really in the past, I feel like 40 years, frankly. But I remember as a kid watching TV and seeing that. What is a consumer union?
Yeah, I mean, we must be sitting at about the same age, because it wasn't active in our lifetime, but it was like the leftover. It was on TV commercials, right, when we were young. And it's probably not a song that more recent generations have even heard. It was a real union, meaning people came together. Certainly it had support of some of the smarter unions. I think it was this, if I do my history right, it was the Cigar Workers Union that actually began, that inspired it. There's a middle tier of unions in the turn of the two centuries ago, where they understood that if the consumers continued to buy their product, that their strike would be less effective. And so there was a really strong, just called an organization. It was nice that it was called a union, right? But now the consumer groups today are like, you know, tell you whether or not the product is good, as opposed to whether or not the workers have a living wage or their slave conditions in them. So what we are desperate for, we could outline how to build it if we want to, just brainstorming, but we're desperate for, I think, a sort of faith, an institution-based national organization that has the moral authority and the credibility and the focus to once again make it so that on the consumer retail side, we get away from individualism, which is the hype of our lifetimes, and we move people back to the idea of the collective. And I think there's so much evidence that every time we actually have these kind of frank conversations with ordinary people, they get the collective, they get it. And the conditions are so extreme now, they get it. So, you know, what the Consumers Union did 120 years ago, 115 years ago, was they would investigate and they would say, okay, we're going to boycott this product to support the workers. And people signed up and pledged to do that and really actually did it. Now, given the hyper-individualism that has been created intentionally in the last 50 years, and the idea that collective is bad, individual is good, collective is bad, and social media and all the stuff, people might say it's impossible. But that's the same thing trade union leaders say about organizing, right? And strikes. And look at all the organizing and strikes going on. So just saying. Again, it's when we do it right. So, the Association of American Association of Retired People, like senior groups, faith houses, like you could start to build a strategy of a quick way, not a shortcut way, but a quick and effective way to build a real consumer union based in some of the institutions that already exist, that have real reach into a real base in this country, and who I think could very easily be moved into the idea that fairness at work is a value that matters.
And so something like that could be deployed. There's a strike at Starbucks, or they can't get their contract. And the consumer union would say, we're calling on all our members to buy your coffee somewhere else, you know, until further notice type of situation. Or
yes, for sure. But also quickly, it'd have to be institutional. Like when you think about Starbucks, for example, there's all these institutional relationships between airports and Starbucks. Like little individuals will be one part of it. But the reason I was saying AARP, houses of faith, like it have to be institutional consumers, hospitals, universities. Like you'd have to just go to war and say, you know, students, we're not going to let our university purchase from here. We're going to be part of the consumers union. So you'd have to make it strategic like everything else, right? And that's about thinking the power of structure analysis through. But it would take about 30 minutes to do it. We don't want to do that on the whole show. But that's what we would be doing to make it effective.
And so the idea is that you also have almost like a wholesale power as well as the sort of the retail power associated with it. All right. Well, let's go on to, you know, some of these the case studies in your book, which basically are experiences that you had over the years, which were more effective than others. I mean, part of what you're trying to sort of dispel, and I think you've already done as we've talked, is like the lessons that you've garnered that the legacy unions failed to understand. I feel like that's really the entire sort of, you know, the generalization of all the books. But one thing that stuck out for me, I guess, was, you know, actually not in your book, but it was, but lessons that have feel like they've been learned was like in this amalgamated, I think you wrote about the amalgamated transit in Kentucky. When they started to negotiate, the first rule that management wanted conditioned before they sit down was like, you can't share what we're negotiating with, what our negotiations with the rest of your membership until we come to a deal. They rejected that. And, you know, you could see within the context of your other case studies, the relevance of that. But will you explain to us why that was so important? Why that was such the right move to make for the amalgamated workers?
Yeah, that story really wrote itself. That's what I like to write when workers do such smart things and they just tell the lesson, like the Chattanooga story we just talked about. But that was not a good example. But so the there's two things that are related that we talk about in the book. One is something called ground rules. And I'm going to argue, there's no number, but no one's challenged it. I think at least 95% of all trade unions in the United States, that feels like a safe number to me, which is horrific, operate under what's called ground rules. So they engage in a negotiation with their employer, sort of pre-sitting down at the table, and they hammer out something called ground rules, which are legal under labor law. Very important thing for people who are facing negotiations and thinking about unionization. They're what we call in the Byzantine nature of labor law, they're what we call non-mandatory subjects of bargaining. Okay. There's mandatory subjects of bargaining, which both parties must agree to take up or there can be charges filed against you. Then there's non-mandatory subjects of bargaining. And we have a lot of information about this in the new book because there's so much confusion about it. So ground rules fall under a non-mandatory subject of bargaining or negotiations, which means you don't have to talk about them. Now, who wants either a corrupt union and or every bad boss or a lazy union wants ground rules? That the first one of which is usually what's called a gag order, which says we agree. There's a few varieties of them. The most common one is we agree not to talk to the media during the course of negotiations. Who violates it first every damn time when the fight gets to a head? Okay, the boss. So for everyone who's ever signed one of those things, there's like lesson after lesson that the employer will violate it first. But anyway, but the majority of unions still actually sign off on language that says we agree not to talk to the media nor to our own members until such time as a full tentative agreement has been reached. And then they come out of months or years, depending on the union, of negotiations, and no member's been briefed on what is going on in their own negotiations. that led to the John Deere rejection of a contract a couple of years ago, by the way. And it's so counterintuitive to me, but that's because I was trained by really good trade union leaders, right, when I was a young organizer. So in the case I wrote about recently, from Louisville, Kentucky, Amalgamated Transit Workers Union leader, she was the first one, Lillian, was the first one, a black woman, in the union, because they just passed a national policy and no other union has it. So first I was sitting down to write about that they had voted in October of last year, October of 2022 at their national convention. Again, more reform-minded leadership getting serious about organizing. They passed a national resolution saying that they embrace transparent, big, and open negotiations, which are the three tests that we're using in the book. Like, are you operating full transparency? You cannot sign a gag rule that says you won't talk to your members if you do that. And then, you know, are you electing a big committee? And are you letting all the members covered by the agreement in the room? So come back to those other two. But on this one, she had a lot of pressure to sign the ground rule. She was newly elected, black woman, hadn't been many of them in leadership of her union and at a bus transit agency. And she didn't take the bait. So she said, you know, I've been told by my national union, I don't have to sign these things and I'm not signing them. And within weeks, one of the first proposals was this really racist proposal called the 3-2-1 proposal, which was to give the largest raise, a 3% raise, to like the handful of white workers who worked for the transit agency, which were like the highest tier kind of engineers for buses and keeping things moving. And then give a 2% raise to the largest unit, which is mostly women of color, bus drivers. And then to give a 1% raise to mostly African-American men who clean and do maintenance around all the bus depots and all the terminals and stuff. So the 3-2-1 proposal is wildly racist, which she points out right away. Like, what do you mean you're going to give 3% to the handful of... So had she signed that gag order or any ground rule, she took the same position that I have taken my entire life. I've never signed a ground rule in my life, never even negotiated them. Boss comes in, says, well, it's time to negotiate ground rules. Actually, they'll do it ahead of time. They won't even do it in front of the workers. They'll just email a bad union and they'll do it in email. But I digress. But, you know, they'll walk in the room and say, OK, let's start off with our proposed ground rules. No talking to the media, no talking to the members, no sharing information, no blah, blah, blah. And I always just wait for that moment, you know, and I say, yeah, thanks for sharing. We really appreciate that and proposal on your part. But since it's not a mandatory subject of negotiations, we'd like to get right to it. Because that's all you have to do. And she did it. And that allowed her to go build the union probably two or three times more powerful than it was going to be to begin with in that fight, because she got to go say to everyone, there are some really racist proposals coming from management. And then it got even worse, which I talk about, where the employer as sort of, when she said, we're going to let all the members come to negotiations, the employer said, you know, why don't we just negotiate at the zoo? By the way, you can have a view of the orangutan exhibit. And that was all real. And there's, you know, like when I was writing The Nation, I had to show them the actual email exchanges, which the lawyers had for the union. So, you know, the level of racism was dripping both in the wage proposals and just in general. And that allowed that union to grow stronger than it's ever been and win a terrific contract where they got 6% across the board raises for every single worker in year one of the contract, 4% in year two. There's just a lot of smart things that you can do when you don't bind yourself and you don't engage your own members in the fight.
It's interesting, too, because the ground rules really seem, I mean, I guess theoretically I could come up with some ideas of ground rules that would not be necessarily inhibit the power of a union, but it's almost like, you know, Matt, who's 6'3" or something, and I, who's 6-foot-ish, were to agree on ground rules when we, you know, before we play a basketball game, no jumping. Well, we're both subject to those, but I mean, it's going to benefit him. You know, when you have a top-down system for the management, that works, because that's their entire sort of like source of authority is top down. It's the opposite when it comes to unions. The authority that these negotiators have is because of the power of the union, of everybody involved in the union. And to cut them off from that, it does seem sort of like intuitively, like that's a bad idea. That's where all your power comes from. It's an interesting dynamic. It's also sort of fascinating to me that it's not, it clearly hasn't been obvious to a lot of unions. Give us an example, within the context. I mean, we should say that you give, you have about seven chapters where you cover, experience you've had with Philadelphia nurses, New Jersey teachers, news writers, journalists, both in New York and LA, nurses out in Western Mass, hotel workers in Marriott, I guess. I don't, and then in Berlin, some, hospital workers. What would you say? Like, I don't know. I mean, what, we can't cover all of them. Well, for you, what are the two or three key lessons out of those fights that you pulled out?
Yeah, that lessons start with the one we were just on, which is full transparency. And by the way, the WGA, the Writers Guild, is exercising full transparency. They have been wildly publishing. I just saw it on Twitter again this morning too. Like, they're publishing their demands, right? Like, the idea that it somehow helps you to keep your demand secret is just, it's, anyway.
In the Writers Guild, we should say, like, the Writers Guild, I mean, I was a former member back in the day when I was in that business, and I remember they would always say, like, we know you guys are real individuals, and you don't like, and there's like, I don't know, there's something, I guess, 11,500 or so members, and they writers are pretty solitary people, and they, you know, in my experience in that business, they all think that they're better than everybody else. That's the way that you succeed in there. And opening it up to everybody at least makes it, what it seems to me to do is it also, like, I have specific people who come to mind from the last writer's strike, but there are people who really have the ability to undercut the power of the union, and the less transparency, the easier it is for some of those people to do so, because they're like, you don't know what they're doing behind closed doors. These guys are idiots. They're giving away the house, or they're doing this and that. The more transparent it is, at least there's a level of trust. There's a level of buy-in. You feel like you have an impact on stuff because you're speaking specifically to specifics. But go ahead.
Absolutely. We sort of walk away. I started to call it high. By the time the book came out, I had changed my language that I've been using for years, which was transparent, big and open negotiations. Those are still the criteria though. But what as organizers do, obsess about semantics, I sort of renamed it high participation, high power negotiations, right? By the time I'm in peer review, trying to crank out that book last summer, and responding to reviewers. And I think those words, high participation, high power, are a better reflection, but the criteria for it and the lesson from every one of those cases you just rattled off, and the German one matters. We might note that in the end, the sort of myth of Germany and how these processes worked over there. But it's about transparency. So no ground rules, no gag order. And you're right. You could sign a ground rule that says we all agree to come on time. For me, it's a control thing. So I'm just not going to agree to any of them. I'm just teach the workers right away. You don't have to listen to this garbage. Yes. I always just say, yes, we're the polite people. We'll be here on time. Next topic, who's late? Them. Anyway. So the second one is about electing, keyword, very large worker committees. Why? Because the employer's going to lie through their teeth most of the time at the negotiations table. True. Sue me. I mean, it's just true. My life experience. And so when you elect a large, when you have a large committee, and you can have a large committee and not elect them. So there's two things. You have a large committee, that's a great start. And if you elect them, even better. But having a large committee, by which I mean every single kind of worker covered by the collective agreement, including every one of those workers by different shifts, if they have different shifts, because the experience for a healthcare worker at 3 a.m. is different than at 3 p.m. So every kind of worker covering every kind of shift is like the minimum for what should be on a committee. And, you know, in big units, that could mean 200, 300 people, right, easily. If you've got a whole hospital to negotiate, right, you get the techs, the nurses, the dietary, housekeeping, the whole thing. So it's a lot of different people. And the reason it matters is because no negotiator, I don't care how many times I've done it and how effective I feel doing it, no negotiator is ever going to understand the workplace the way all the workers do. And none of them are going to be able to fact check the employer at the table. When I go to negotiations, there's hundreds of workers in the room with me every single time. And I just get to look around at, you know, for the fact checking because it's going to be immediate and on the spot. It makes the employer effing crazy. So that's big. I prefer elected committees because I describe it in the chapter on Philadelphia. And I didn't always have it this way, but later, as I was aging, you know, in the negotiations and union organizing world, I realized the role of the organizing and the structure tests, what we call the structure tests, that I wanted workers to understand from day one that if they weren't engaged in participating actively from the contract survey process on, they could make any demand they wanted, but they weren't going to win. So electing committees, I've started to set rules later in my life, and obviously voted on by the workers themselves, that said, we're not even going to open up negotiations until 65% of the workers or greater by unit and by shift have filled in the contract survey. We're not even going to put a proposal across the table until at least 65% of you are doing it. And that's a, I think, beautifully high threshold, right? So from day, and when they say, why? We can't get that in our unit. And I say, yes, you can. And when the first unit does it and gets 65% on their initial contract survey, then you just hold that up and say, okay, well, this unit did it, so start doing it. And we make the criteria for electing a member of the negotiations committee contingent on high participation in your unit, because you ain't gonna win if you aren't teaching the workers from day one. No clever negotiators winning at the table. It's you and your coworkers. And if you're not actively engaging, starting from day one, the building of this contract, the proposals, your opinions, you're not gonna win. That's just like being honest about the 12-month thing, right? Just be honest with people. They really appreciate honesty, it turns out. And then the last one, is about open. And when I say open, and Abby Lawler and I mean in the book, we define it, we say open to all the workers covered by the collective bargaining agreement. I actually don't mean open to the whole universe. Maybe my years in Nevada, where there's a very powerful right-wing anti-tax movement, and I had very large public sector units, you know, if I argued for open, first of all, you wouldn't win under the law. Like, there's case law that says, I've had to use it because many employers have challenged us when we say we're going to let any worker covered by the agreement into the room. Sometimes 500 walk in. That's good. Employers will always challenge it. So we've been able to win on that. But also, I wouldn't want it open to everyone. You can bring a guest speaker, you know, Barbara Madeloni, he mentioned, I think, you know, you can bring in one of the case studies from Western Mass where she's from, but it's the hospital union, nurses union. They brought people in to speak and testify about the conditions for patients in the community. You're always allowed to bring a guest person to speak. But the right to attend negotiations is fundamental for the workers. And so for me, that's the final threshold. And it's so powerful because if you've got a skeptical worker, if management's running a line and then you know that they're lying, you know, it's what Lillian did. It's come out of the room. Right. I mean, I've in right to work for less states, which I've worked in many of, sharpened my skill on all these things. I would say to the most skeptical worker who was not a dues paying member, come on in the room. Come on in the room and talk about that proposal because I'm organizing them. We hear what they care about. And they're like, yeah, but I'm not a member. But I don't believe in the union. I'm like, that's cool. No problem. Why don't you just come? We're cool with that. Why don't you just come to negotiations and actually present on that topic? And you know what happens? It's never not happened. That even a potentially anti-union worker will walk into that room, see all their coworkers, realize it's the employer that's holding them back and not this thing called the union, and they convert, like they change their view of what a union is. So those are the things that we pull out from the case studies, from the real life stuff, and they're all recent, right? I mean, 2016 is the oldest one in there. So they're all recent examples, which I always like to do, of workers using effective methods. This is essentially the no shortcuts. This is the organizer's approach to negotiations, right? That's what I was taught, and that's what I'm espousing. And now I had a lot of people, I'll stop here, but it was actually the Germans. I was doing a ton of work in Germany starting in 2019 when they translated my first book. And now they're all in German, all of the books, including this one's already halfway translated. And they said to me, you keep talking about this big and open negotiation stuff you do. You got to spell it out for us, because you probably don't just wake up one day, Jane, and open up the room. And I'm like, you're right. We don't. It starts with the contract survey process. And it's not anonymous. And it's one-to-one. And it's an organizing conversation. And you say, if 65% of people in your unit don't get involved in the contract survey, we're not even going to go to the table. So do you want to change things? Okay, we'll get involved. So they literally said to me over and over, a team of organizers in Germany, write a damn book on it. So we can credit the German organizers for actually making me write the book and then hiring a graduate student named Abby, who did a great job.
That's amazing. I mean, it really does feel, I think the thing that comes from both these books is that organizing is really a practice. In many respects, as opposed to sort of a one-off action, it is something that is ongoing and builds on itself as you go through. And I would imagine too. I mean, the difficult part is it's hard to organize. It's hard to negotiate when you have 500 people who are stakeholders. You know, sort of developing that position that makes it more difficult in the short run, but in the long run, what ultimately comes out of that process is a lot more rock solid and a lot more undeniable than something that just rests on one person's assumptions of what the different people are gonna want in that in that context. I feel like we could talk for hours about this stuff.
Can I just say one thing about the smart comment you just made? Because you always make them. That's why I enjoy being here. Just to that point really quickly, the point of the 500 in the room, and yes, I mean, I've had national union trade leaders say to me, you're crazy to do this. You know what I mean? They're all just fighting in there and stuff. And I'm like, oh my God, first of all, you have a diminished view of workers. But second of all, what it does, Sam, is it prepares them to know how to defend the agreement once they sign it. It builds what we call in the book governing power. The first I say in the book that this phase between the election, where they first learn to build solidarity and unify and overcome management's objections, that's the election phase. The phase of the first contract negotiations in particular is what I call the governing phase, where workers learn how to come to compromises, how to work things out among themselves, how to govern, because the left, whatever that means, or progressives in this country have so little experience actually governing that learning how to do it is the point of the first contract negotiations, in my opinion, and my life experience. So they're learning what it would take to sort of run their workplace. In the case of Einstein, what would it take to really be in charge of your place of work? You know, like actually control the production process in some old lingo, like actually make the rules at work and then enforce them. That's what they learn when you're willing to have 500, 400, 300,000 people come in the room. And by the way, during the negotiations, they're silent. So there is a set of rules that I always ask the workers to embrace, which is when the employer's in the room, everyone's silent. When the employer's not in the room, you know, holy hell happens. And that's as it should be.
Right. You don't want the employer to see any. They assume there's going to be dissension because there's always dissension with 500 people, but you don't want them to know where it is, I would imagine, from a strategic or tactical standpoint. All right, so final question, a general one again. How would you describe, where is it coming from? Because I suspect I would know the answer if it's just yes or no. But how would you describe the change that you've seen over the past, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, however many years it is. I mean, really, it sort of feels like to me the big benchmark strike was that Chicago teachers strike. But how would you explain that change? Like, where does it, is it cyclical? Where does it come from? How does it manifest itself? Like, how would you describe that? Because it does feel like there is this sort of change within unions. Some, you feel like the leadership is being pulled by, you know, the the membership, and they're just sort of hanging on for dear life, you know, sort of like talking in a way that they think will placate the membership and others. You've seen changes in leadership. Where is this coming from?
Yeah, I think you're right. It starts in Chicago, 2012. And I think, you know, workers are willing to take high risk and fight if they believe there's a credible plan to win. And the term credible plan to win is literally like, that's an art form in the union that trained me. Like, those words are not ones I made up. Like, I was jammed in my head. For workers to take high risk, they have to understand be part of making it, right? So that's the key thing. If they're part of making it, high contract survey thresholds, non-anonymous, all that stuff, right? They're making a credible plan to win, and they're willing to step out of the security of anonymity and risk aversion and actually take action. So I think it's been really important that there's been some very high-profile strikes, beginning with Chicago in 2012, where people saw workers fighting like mad in a massive supermajority strike and winning against the odds, against really stiff opposition. And then you carry that into 2018, you know, and in 2018, we have the highest number of workers on strike in 30 years. That's just before the pandemic, right? Huge education strikes, but not just that. The Marriott strike that we're covering in the book, that was a national Marriott strike against the most powerful corporation in the world. And academics love to say, you know, well, you might be able to take on a school district, Jane, as they like to say to me. But, you know, low-wage workers can't take on the largest corporation in the world. And, okay, that's why we put that fight in there, because, yeah, they damn well did, right? It's about organizing power and strategy and not leaving power on the table. So I think it comes from workers seeing other workers winning. That's fundamental to the motivation. And then the abject conditions the employers are putting us under. Everyone's basically going to be an Uber driver. If workers don't fight back right now, whether you're a writer in Hollywood, a teacher in Oakland, you know, a UPS driver, whatever you are, you're just about to become, you know, a poor, Uberized, have no rights, have no future, have no life worker, unless and until people fight back, and they are fighting back.
Yeah. It's the gigification of every sector. And like, I mean, it's just, it's great that you say that, because in reading about the WGA or the writers' strike or earlier today, they cite that as being their number one complaint. And it was the same thing when we covered the UPS pending strike. That's also the same complaint. So there is a theme here where employers understand that this is their most efficient avenue to undercutting labor power is to exploiting these labor or these gig laws.
Absolutely. All the way. Completely. And whether or not they're formally exploiting them or informally exploiting them, that is what's happening. The titans of Silicon Valley, in fact, are sort of winning these structural changes in the workplace that we've known all along are devastating. And the more workers experience it, the more pissed off they're becoming. And then you add to that a pandemic where people just got shat all over by the employer class. And you've got a bunch of young people who haven't been steeped in 50 years of McCarthyism or the leftover of it. And you've got a nice thing going on right now where workers, thank goodness, are feeling a sense of urgency and fighting back.
You know, when you say 2018, that was the year of the Red State Revolt, where you had these non-unionized, really, teachers in states, I can't remember all of them, but Kentucky and
Arizona, West Virginia.
States where there was there was right to work, so-called right to work laws, and teachers struck back. And I remember going to the AFT convention that year, and particularly in the context of the middle, sort of the middle management of the union, if you will, sort of the more localized leaders, who had become, I don't know if radicalized is the right word, but they certainly were like, didn't realize we could do that. Like they, you know, they had been in the union for a long time, and they would just sort of had gotten into a place where they just, it was taken as granted that they had no power. Mm. And when they saw these teachers, it reinvigorated their sort of sense of like, maybe going on strike is not such the like sort of terrifying thing and futile thing that we thought it was. And it really seemed to impact people. And I feel like that has just built upon itself. Well, you know, I wanted to talk to you about the Glacier Northwest Teamsters and the UPS strike, which we could be just a couple of months away from. We're going to have you back to talk about those things. These are going to be important things. You really do get the sense, particularly with the UPS thing, if that UPS strike happens, this is something that is going to be sort of national in a way that we haven't really, you know, Starbucks is national, but it's a series of like sort of localized things. This UPS thing is going to be something that I think, like, you know, people in one state and
the pilots,
people they know, and the pilots as well. I mean, this could be a very, very important summer in terms of a labor action. And
we should. It's so funny you say that, because I literally this weekend just wrote two different opinion pieces that I'm pitching places. One is on Glacier and what it means. And one is on the UPS UAW, the change in leadership. I don't want to give it away now, but analogizing it to some recent other struggles and talking about the promise of what may come. So both topics, things that are central in my mind, I'm writing about them and would love to come back and talk about them anytime.
Fantastic. Well, the book is Rules to Win By: Power and Participation in Union Negotiations, written by Jane McAlevey, and of course with Abby Lawler. We will put a link to that at majority.fm and in the podcast and YouTube description. Jane, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Likewise. Great to see you, Sam and Emma, and the whole crew behind all of you. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Jane.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we'll have fun.
Yes, we will.
646-257-3920. We'll take your phone calls. Also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. It is justcoffee.coop, not .com, .coop, because it is a co-op. It is completely employee, worker-owned. And they extend that dynamic to their suppliers, too, like growers in Central America. It first came out of, like, they were repping the coffee growers in the Zapatistas and years and years ago. So great company, great coffee. Also, you can get the Majority Report blend. So check it out. Our oldest sponsor. The sponsor actually predates this show.
Wow.
They were sponsors of Break Room Live. That's why Marin also advertises, but he chose the wrong blend for his coffee. I chose the right one. So, I mean,
such is life.
I don't know why I'm on like a kick of like crapping on Marin this week.
And they were already the justice themed like coffee for Break Room.
They
like back at that time, because that's not a political show, but they were still
Break Room Live.
Yeah, Break Room Live.
Break Room Live was sort of a political show.
Okay.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and I mean, part of it was.
I guess, I forget Marin does comedy, does politics, too.
Yeah, well, we would do both. That was sort of the idea. You would do more social commentary, I would do more political commentary, and we would just get in arguments about it constantly off set. Somebody from Just Coffee was a fan of that show, and so that's how that relationship started. Mike Moon was the guy, actually. I don't think he works there anymore. So check that out. Also, don't forget amquickie.com. Check it out. Get a newsletter. Get the news first thing in the morning by 9 a.m. in your email box. You can also join our Discord. We have over 8,000 members of our Discord, majoritydiscord.com. You can buy some merch, shop.majorityreportradio.com. Cedar Seeds will be up online hopefully in the next day or so. Still plenty of time for you to start growing your seeds and getting them out to your backyard or into your onto your fire escape. You can put a big plant on your maybe a little dusty, depending on where you live.
Yeah, check out the laws in your state.
Yes, but I don't know. I mean, even still, like, somebody may come and borrow that tree, that plant, if you put it on your fire escape. But who knows? Am I stuttering again? Like,
I think Ping is having a little bit of a hiccup.
So weird.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we can still hear you because the audio does not go through your video. So,
why, Mike? It has to be my computer.
Right now, it's not just you though; it's also Emma. So, I think there might be a ping.
Okay, that makes me feel better. Then I'll have to buy a new computer. Emma, what's happening on ESVN? It's like the Cafe Depresso over there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yesterday was more like cafe anxiety because I thought the Rangers still had a chance, which obviously they don't anymore. So, you can check out the episode yesterday. We spoke at length about the wonder that is Steph Curry setting that Game 7 record. Spoke about the NBA playoffs more broadly. And a lot of interesting storylines in the NHL. The Winnipeg Jets coach like publicly shitting on his players. And then we went through the NFL draft, who won and who lost, youtube.com/ESPN show.
Matt, what's happening Left Reckoning, not quite as depressive.
Yeah, no, we're gonna have actually a pretty fun show, not morbid or anything. Chris James of Not Even a Show Comedian is going to be joining us. We're talking about some fun stuff, including his use of AI voices of say Sebastian Gorka or Ben Shapiro to call into right wing TV shows and talk about like how how large their head is in the case of Gorka or how
we played
short
that
they
before.
Are.
Yeah,
yeah. Right. He also has been calling, for instance, like the Tennessee lawmakers who are expelling other lawmakers for supporting gun rights, or the North Dakota and Minnesota lawmakers who voted against school lunch bills. So we're going to talk to him about, a use case for AI that I actually find a lot of promise in. A lot of people take me as a naysayer, but I've actually found
many people are saying,
yeah, there's a lot of promise here. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to our post game tonight.
All right. 646-257-3920 is the number. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back. Back, back, back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday.
My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
My
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on.
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.